Today is January 19th, 2005. Our topic of discussion today is public hearing on House Bill 2025. And do we have any special announcements, Sandy, that I am not aware of?
There is, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Committee members, I just wanted to bring to your attention that we have received via my email address multiple submissions of testimony. They are at the bottom of the packet, paper clip. Some of them are emails, some of them are facts, and the requesters have requested that we acknowledge them. I'm not going to read all of the names, but they will be submitted and archived into the minutes for that, so you can read or peruse through them at your convenience.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to simply note that one of those that I added today is a testimony from the Eugene Water and Electric Board, which I take it to be in opposition to House Bill 2025, that is also that we've added to the packet just a minute ago. Thank you. Okay. At the at the conclusion of the last meeting, Lynn Campbell from the Oregon Citizens, Oregon Citizens for Citizens with Safe Drinking Water, was on the stand, and she graciously accepted or postponed her testimony until today because we were running out of time. And if Lynn is here, I'd like to pick up where we left off on Monday.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak again on the issue of fluoridation. For the record, my name is Lynn Campbell, and I am Director of Oregon Citizens for Safe Drinking Water, based in Lake Oswego. Those of us here today opposing House Bill 2025 have come because we care deeply about water. We believe, as does the United Nations, that water is a fundamental need, fundamental human need, and therefore that access to safe water is a human right which must be protected not just for the majority, but for every individual. From our perspective, fluoridation is first and foremost an issue of water which has much broader implications than if it were only about dental health. And so it is appropriate that this bill be heard here in the Water Committee rather than another. You will probably have noted from the notebook of testimony that I submitted on Monday that fluoridation raises many significant issues, which I hope you will explore in depth. Obviously, today I must keep my remarks short, and although we normally highlight the lack of appropriate testing regulation and certification of product, today I want to focus on only two issues: what FDA says about fluoride and the problem of separating fact from opinion and, almost more importantly, from spin. So if you do have your notebooks and have the opportunity to turn to tab one, that would be helpful. There is probably no single more important document than the FDA response in December 2000 to the U.S. House Committee on Science. Fluoride, when ingested for the purpose of reducing tooth decay, the word ingested is key, is an unapproved drug under FDA regulation, a drug that FDA has never even looked at, let alone approved for safety or effectiveness. Just to be clear, FDA's confirmation extends to all such products, including all prescription fluoride drops, tablets, and vitamins, even those distributed to children through the Department of Human Services King Fluoride Program in schools in non-fluoridated communities. Parents are never told, and so consent is never fully informed. I urge you to keep this single fact that fluoride is a drug in mind as you deliberate about the ethics of this mandate and the nature of all drugs, having both benefits and risks, not all of which are understood, which we're learning now about Vioxx and Celebrex when we're talking about chronic ingestion over long periods of time. Proponents say, but FDA doesn't regulate water. EPA does. Yet in your notebook, you'll find that EPA told the Committee on Science, this is in tab 4, that it does not regulate drinking water treatment chemicals. No federal agency does. EPA regulates fluoride as a contaminant in source water. EPA deals only with safety. EPA has absolutely no authority to determine the efficacy of a drug. The bottom line is we have a huge regulation problem. If you look to in tab 2, this is, I think, of prime importance. This issue carries historical baggage, and there are challenges, again, in determining fact because there are so many beliefs, opinions, as well as political spin. Performing due diligence requires going beyond reviews, conclusions, and secondhand information and looking as best as one can at the original data. I want to cite several important examples, working backwards first from the spin document to the original document. Toward the back of tab 2, you'll find a press release issued by the OHSU Dental School. The nation's first state-by-state report card had just been published, and according to this release, Oregon did very poorly. After listing a lot of bad grades, it's probably in about paragraph 3, including Oregon's F in fluoridation because such a small percent of our population is fluoridated, they finally report one good piece of news. On the bright side, it says, Oregon scored higher in the areas of visits to the dentist for adults and older persons with a grade of B. That's the only good grade that's mentioned. Then, in the release, three different dentists, including Oregon's dental director, are quoted saying, every Oregon community should be fluoridated. Well, we've been conditioned for years to associate fluoride with tooth decay, so we're left with the impression we must have a lot of decay in Oregon, and fluoridation is the obvious way to fix it. That's the spin. But now for the report. If you look toward the front of tab 2 and about the third page in, you'll see the state-by-state report card. And if you find Oregon down on the left, and you see that I've highlighted our F in fluoridation, but if you look to the right, you'll find that there are other good grades that were never reported. Oregon got a B for the edentulous elderly. That's keeping their natural teeth. That's not supposed to happen if you don't have fluoride in the water. Oregon also got a B in the oral health of children category, which if you look at what that means, it's the cavity category. So why weren't we told? Because there is an agenda in Oregon to fluoridate, regardless of the facts. And if people know they can have decent teeth for a lifetime without fluoride in the drinking water, they won't buy what the promoters are selling. The second example of spin is in tab 10. In Mundy's testimony, both sides of this debate, Dr. Hersey and Dr. Tempest, cited the most reliable information we have for gauging fluoridation's goal of reducing decay without causing dental fluorosis. In 1986-87, the National Institute of Dental Research collected data on over 39,000 children in 84 geographic areas. This is the largest survey ever done in this country. The survey information was written up by Brunel and Carlos and is referenced by the CDC in its October 1999 report that's in the tab, saying that, and it's highlighted, by the mid-1980s, the mean DMFS scores, DMFS refers to decayed, missing...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative Byron. Thank you. I'm sorry. I missed which tab we're talking about.
I think we're talking about tab 10.
10. Thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And it's the CDC MMWR document. By the mid-1980s, the mean DMFS scores, and that's decayed, missing, and filled tooth surfaces, which is how they are, you know, counting the decay, of children who lived in communities with fluoridated water were only 18% lower than among those living in communities without fluoridated water. The report says only because this is lower than the claims made for reductions in decay from the early studies. But the actual spin is the 18% figure. Then if you turn, you can look at the hard data. You have the Brunel and Carlos study. And if you look at the bottom at table 6, you see columns for children with lifelong exposure compared to children with no fluoridation exposure. For the 18% difference, we'd probably expect to see multiple two-surface difference between the two groups, wouldn't you think? But if you look at the data at the bottom, you see that out of a total 128 tooth surfaces in a child's mouth, the fluoridated kids had 2.79 decayed surfaces and the non-fluoridated only 3.39. That is a difference of only 0.6 or less than one tooth surface out of a total of 128. In other words, a tiny fraction. So how did they get the 18%? Well, it's just the percentage difference between two tiny numbers, 2.79 and 3.39, which would still be 18% if there were 10 tooth surfaces in a child's mouth or if there were 10,000. That 18% would never change. What should have been reported is the 0.6 difference as a percent of 128, like I say, which is less than one-half of 1% difference, a number that is statistically insignificant. Further, they didn't even bother to find out if the children were ingesting the water or how much. They didn't control for Pitt and Fisher decay or baby bottle tooth decay, both of which, if you read the dental literature, you find fluoride is not effective in preventing either of those major types of decay. The truth is that these decay rates in the largest survey ever done were nearly identical. I urge the committee to be wary of reductions in decay expressed as percentages. Only the hard numbers will really give you a sense of what the differences truly are. My final example of spin versus the actual study is in tab 15, and that's on the environmental effects of fluoride. First, the spin. In the notebook that was provided to you on Monday by proponents, in answer to the question, is fluoride harmful to salmon, they've written, according to environmental analysis, there's virtually no possibility of environmental impact because the amount of fluoride in optimally fluoridated water is 0.7 to 1.2 parts per million, which is actually lower than the natural marine seawater background level of 1.4 parts per million. They go on to denigrate the Dam Care Day studies done on the Columbia, demonstrating that they neither understand the studies or fish. Dr. Engelking of the University of Oregon is someone who does, and I am sorry that he's not here with us today. I have, however, provided you in tab 15 with a copy of an email that he sent to fluoridation promoter Lori Johnson, which explains that these important studies and the serious harm fluoride poses for salmon with a threshold of harm at only 2 parts per million. Recognizing fluoride's deleterious effect on other aquatic life, Environment Canada has established a water quality guideline for inorganic fluorides at only 0.12 parts per million, or about 9 times lower than what is added to drinking water. Remember that according to the American Water Works Association, people only consume less than 1% of water, and the remaining 99% ends up, most of it, back in our streams and our rivers. In closing, I would like to ask the committee to please exercise caution. As you do your due diligence, please require source documents. Insist, Representative Cremel, on the double-blind studies that you asked for on Monday. Pose the hard questions. The seriousness of this proposal demands it, and we are confident that after a full review of the facts, you will vote no. I would simply like to say that because of an Oregonian article that ran this morning that published our number, I got many phone calls starting at 7 a.m. this morning, people explaining that they grew up in fluoridated water, it didn't help them, they had health problems, some talked about allergies. Obviously, that's not proven. These were anecdotal stories that came over the phone. People are concerned. Many of the people that we would have liked to bring today, there simply wasn't enough notice for them to clear their schedules. So if the committee would consider potentially additional public hearings, we would be grateful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Schaffner.
Thank you, and thanks for your testimony. On the tab number 10, the morbidity and mortality weekly report, do they have data that show the rate of use of fluoridated toothpaste among those tested when they were at the 50 to 70% mark, and then relative, and then how that went up when they came to the 18% mark, and how that changed, or if it did, or do they have that or not? Did the people that were studied, did the rate or the use of fluoridated toothpaste go up among that group that was studied?
I don't know. I'd be happy to find out for you. Jeff Green, our national director, is in the room, and perhaps he might be able to answer that question.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Thank you very much for bringing your testimony to us, and we'll be on this topic for a little while. So,
thank you.
We'll probably see you here again. Thank you. At this time, Chair, I'd like to call Dr. Leahy.
Good afternoon, Doctor, and
thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Chairman, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you very much. I also represent the Oregon Pediatric Society as well as the Oregon Medical Association. I'm a pediatrician. I've been here in Salem for about 28 years. And this is a subject that's near and dear to our hearts. As pediatricians, I won't read my testimony, but I'll just touch on a few topics that are important to us. Prevention is critical to us. We advocate for vaccine usage. We advocate for seatbelt usage. We advocate for wearing bike helmets and on and on and on. And we look on fluoride as a way to prevent caries in children. In Salem, our water is fluoridated. We fluoridated back in 1965 or 64. They actually did some studies here in Salem that showed a 65% reduction in the incidence of caries. Kaiser, just north of us here, fluoridated their water about 1980, and it's been fluoridated since. You have a list, I think, of the communities in the state that are fluoridated. As you look at children's teeth, or as I look at children's teeth, we see them in our office every day. We do the pre-dental evaluations. These children come in from outlying areas, and they come in from Salem also, but the majority of them come in from outlying areas to have their teeth repaired. These are children that have not just a small cavity, but they end up having teeth capped and multiple repairs. The state pays about, on the average, of $5,000 per child to have these dental restorations done. And these are not just in primary teeth. These are also in permanent teeth. We think it's some state money. And I don't have the total amount from OMAP, but I think that's something that could be obtained as to just how much money we spend each year on repairing children's teeth. And that money could be used elsewhere in the Oregon Health Plan, maybe expanding out to the adult population, however you want to do that. But if we can even reduce that percentage, 20%, 30%, I'm not sure just how realistic the 60% is anymore, but it can be a reduction. So that's one thing to look at is actually what the state is actually paying to restore children's teeth right now. The other thing that I would like to address, there's been issues about the health of people that use fluoridated water. I'm not an expert in fluoridation. I'm not an expert in water quality issues. Portland water is often offered as, water that's pure and it's great. It is chlorinated water. They use a chloramination process, which is a combination of chlorine and ammonia, so that, in fact, however you want to define pure water, you already have one of the elemental compounds in there, which is chlorine. Fluoride, which is basically a product, or it's a combination of fluorine, which is the natural occurring element, is what people use to add into the water to strengthen teeth and look at bone construction. There's bromine, chlorine, fluorine, and iodine, they're all in the basic element table. Those are all chemicals or elements that are available in our air, in our ground. They're all around us every day. And those are very potent chemicals. We use them for various, disinfectants. We use them for getting rid of pathogens. But using the fluorine or the fluoride compounds in very small concentrations, as has been done, has been shown to help out with children's teeth. We deal with children. They are, quote, a silent majority, in some situations a minority. They don't have a chance to speak up. They don't have anybody often speaking for them on a statewide level. And I appreciate people's concerns about health risks. There's been various things thrown out about allergies, cancer. Does this cause birth defects, mental retardation, all sorts of things that may be associated with fluoridated water. So far, we had the past Surgeon General give a presentation. The Surgeon General has advocated for routine fluoridation of public water supplies. I have to fall back on the science of that's been occurring over the last 40 to 50 years. Maybe some of the studies are flawed, but the weight of the evidence to date that I can see would point that fluoridation of public water supplies does help, and especially it helps children who oftentimes don't have anybody speaking up for them. I think if the citizens of Oregon are genuinely concerned about their water supply and really feel that they don't trust what is being put in there, then I would advocate that each one of us have our own water filter at home, or we drink bottled water and even filter that, because those water sources can be contaminated. And the final health risk on a lot of these things is never going to be solved, I don't think, because you can always find one study here, one study there, and you end up coming back as to what seems to be the current weight of evidence. And that's the only thing I would urge the committee to keep in mind, that at this point, from the medical community and certainly from the pediatrician standpoint, we feel that the evidence strongly supports the use of fluoridated water to prevent caries in children, and that the state actually probably could save money. I can't say that for sure because I haven't done a study with OMAP to tell you just how much money is being spent every year on dental restorations in children. Just one side note, why do you even bother to repair kids' teeth? Who cares? They're going to fall out anyway. Well, it impacts their school health. It impacts their general health. I've had kids in the hospital because of severe dental caries and abscesses that go up into their sinuses, and it's a real mess. We like to prevent that again, and I'll come back and talk about prevention anytime with anybody for children, and that's where I think the state spends their best money is on prevention.
Thank you, Doctor. Questions for Dr. Lace?
Representative Dalton does.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Lace, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Traveled to Tanzania lately?
Pardon?
Have you traveled to Tanzania lately?
I came back in October, yes.
That's great. Dr. Lace does a lot of work with orphanages in Tanzania and volunteers an incredible amount of time to go work with those kids and make sure they're all right. Out of curiosity, I know you can't... it's difficult to make sort of a comparison between different countries and sort of different, completely different even approaches to how you take care of kids. But you get a sense of what teeth are like in other countries and some of the work that you've done? I'm just out of curiosity.
You mean in terms of what general dental care there is and what their teeth are like? It's a big problem. Because not only do they not have access to what we would call, sort of a common level of medical care, but they certainly don't have access to dental care at all. The only saving grace for many of these children that you meet in a developing country is that they don't also have access to Coca-Cola. They don't have access to all of our sugar products. And for the example of the orphanages that I'm involved with, they have boiled rice, boiled beans, and boiled cornmeal every day. These are relatively high fiber, low, simple carbohydrate mixes. Toothbrushes, toothpaste for these kids are always a big item. We encourage that, but and their teeth are not good. But I guess if I had to pick and choose, I'd rather be in a developing country that didn't have access to all the sugar that we have in our environment right now. And say, gosh, if you had to pick and choose, that would probably be better for dental hygiene. That has an impact in this country. There's no question about it. Everything put in the equation, you know, trying to control all the variables, if we could reduce the exposure to sugar on these children's teeth, it would help. But I think, you know, here again, you have to fall back on the big studies, and I guess I fall prey to what the American Academy of Pediatrics says and what the Surgeon General says, and I guess I'll put my faith in their studies and say that, you know, let's go for the children, and those things would suggest that fluoridation of water supplies does make a difference on children's oral hygiene, and it impacts their overall general health.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much,
Thank
Doctor.
You.
We appreciate very much your taking time out of a busy schedule to come and share your comments with us. At this time, I'd like to ask Kathleen Bradley from the Office of Family Health, DHS. She's provided us, colleagues, with some information that was requested at the last hearing, and we're going to have a very busy schedule today, but I'd like you just to quickly, if you would, kind of go over this and highlight it for us. And if there are not too many questions, colleagues, Kathleen is probably someone that we can get a hold of, that, you know, individually, and ask her those questions as we go along. Please.
Thank you, Chair Johnson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm an administrator for the Department of Human Services Office of Family Health. I believe what you have in front of you is responses to some of the questions that you raised on Monday. What the department has attempted to do is to try and do a review of some of the critical questions you had in relation to some of the science, as well as some of the financial concerns that you had and the population impacts. One of the questions that was raised was about the SMILE survey that we presented and whether that could actually be abstracted or correlated with the counties so that we could really understand where the results of the 57% really could be tied to fluoridated or non-fluoridated areas. Unfortunately, we're not really able to because of the number of variables involved in that. The largest is we actually surveyed children in the schools, which doesn't take into account with where they live. So the fact that the school may be or may be not fluoridated, where they live may or may not be fluoridated, and other issues related to that, we really can't give you a response. What I can tell you is that we've taken note of your question, and in future surveys, we're actually going to look at the ability to correlate this kind of information. The second was to provide a summary of research demonstrating that fluoride does not provide a health risk. The response that we have to that from our epidemiologists is that virtually all the compounds used in fluoridated water dissolve completely before human consumption. That's 99.9%. And that the strongest research results that we have in peer-reviewed scientific journals indicate with prevailing evidence that not a single article has ever been published in what would be considered to be good science or science that's actually been reviewed by peers. We've also identified for you four summaries that we think are extremely credible in terms of being a summary of the research, and all of them demonstrate an absence of any evidence that optimally fluoridated water creates any health risks. And these are all fairly recent, 2001 through 2003, both state and international reports of health. The question that was asked by Representative Kremel about a double-blind study is certainly a very valid question to ask, because that really is the gold standard of science as we understand it today. The response to that, in short, is that no, we do not have any double-blind studies. Part of that is because our understanding of that methodology, of that science, came about after the predominance of weight of an understanding of fluoridation having a positive impact on dental caries had already come about. to be able to do a double-blind study, which is when neither the researcher nor the patient or the client knows whether they're getting the placebo, rests on the ethical assumption that that the evidence is that the treatment is better than the placebo. And in this case, what happens is that we can't actually get this approved by an IRB or an institutional review board, because their understanding would be that the science already indicates that the utilization of fluoridation actually is an advantage. An example of this most recently that you've probably heard about was some research that was being done by CDC that was evaluating the effectiveness of diet and exercise in the prevention of diabetes. Preliminary analysis of that data showed that the intervention was so effective that the study had to be prematurely stopped, and that intervention of diet and exercise had to be offered to all participants in the study. So that really is the crux of that conundrum, that we're not really able to do a double-blind study because of the prevalence of the data at this time. The next couple of questions all deal with issues of cost and have broader implications on that side. We also have a table that's been revised and corrected that's attached in the back that will break things down by community so that you can look at the community costs to add fluoride. A revised estimation of the overall infrastructure costs would be a little over $23 million. For the breakdown of costs for the individual rate payers up front, it would be approximately $12.5 or $12.61, and on an ongoing yearly cost, it would be $1.58. So all of these costs, I think, will bring them much more in line than where they were on Monday and are a much more accurate reflection of anticipation. The other question was the potential number of Oregonians that would be impacted by this bill, and the total impact would be 1.9 million statewide, which would be about 70% of the overall state population if we looked at the 20% that currently already do have fluoridation as well. And then the last page and a half that I have there, we did respond to the points that were raised by the Oregon Citizens for Safe Drinking Water. In short, we disagree with all four points, and we do explicate further as to why, from the perception of the epidemiologist in the department, that we are not in agreement with those points and would be further happy to elaborate those at a later point in time.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Cummel. Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do we go from $2.5 million to $12 million in 2 days, and on Friday will it be $30 million? I don't understand. Can you explain that to me?
Jensen and Representative Dalto, it's a very appropriate question. What we had originally pulled together for you on Monday were minimal infrastructure costs, if you'll recall, of the feed equipment and fluoridation only. These revised estimates are a more comprehensive picture and a much more accurate reflection. I also have David Leland here from the Water Department that can speak to the committee as a whole or with you individually if you need further definition on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate very much your getting this back to us promptly, and with that, we will probably see you again.
Thank you very much, and we're very pleased to provide you with any information you need. Thank you.
Okay. At this point, we're going to go to our public testimony. Do we have any other sign-up sheets?
Oh, yeah.
3, 4. Okay. The first person, we have one on the first sheet. We have a Brett Foster who says he's outside of the 100-mile limit, could we have the, we will always try to extend to those people outside of the district who may need, or outside of 100 miles, who may need to get on their way home, the opportunity to be first at the public testimony. I appreciate that. Appreciate your being here.
Good afternoon, Chair Jensen. My name is Brent Foster. I'm here today representing Columbia Riverkeeper and Willamette Riverkeeper. I'll start by saying I can say with a fair degree of certainty that fluoridation is not a communist plot to affect our minds. It is not any number of other kind of conspiracy theories, which was one of my first assumptions when I first got my assignment to look at the toxicity of fluoride. And specifically, my background is I always considered myself pro-fluoride. Thought it was good for kids. Got fluoride treatments growing up. I spent a lot of time as a child in oral surgery. And so I had a fair amount of respect for your teeth. I was given the task by Columbia Riverkeeper of looking at whether or not the addition of fluoride to Hood River's water supply could pose a threat to salmon. And when I first got that assignment, my response was, are you joking? How could fluoride, that we all know is good for your teeth, do anything bad for salmon? I think I made some jokes about, well, maybe it would give salmon stronger teeth and things like that. Unfortunately, what I found is has been surprising. Is my microphone fading in and out here? Very quickly, I found that U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, National Marine Fisheries Service, and pretty much every fish biologist I talked to that was familiar at all with the issue of fluoride and its effect on salmon all had one conclusion, and that was that fluoride was very toxic from a salmon perspective. That was shocking to me, and it also kind of opened my eyes to what were a number of other issues. I assumed I knew everything there was to know about fluoride, and I learned quickly that I didn't. And so that's something of a metaphor for, I think, the task before you. If you come here thinking you know there's everything to know about fluoride, I hope you have enough space to be able to think, well, maybe I can learn something new. I did want to pass this out.
And while Brett is doing that, for Brett and for the remainder of the people to testify, as I went through and did my arithmetic, we are on a extremely tight time schedule. We like to start on time. We like to end on time. And that would mean about 3 minutes for every person, which would include any questions that the sub-panel, I would suggest we be careful with the amount of questions that we're asking, if it's possible. Representative Dalton.
How many people are signed up?
24.
I did also want to pass out, this is testimony from Oregon State Public Interest Research Group that couldn't be here today. They asked me to submit it to you. I will try to move as quick as possible. The long and the short of it is I provided you some documents. I want to walk through them quickly because within the fisheries community, there really is no question that I can see that fluoride poses a potential health for salmon, a potential threat for salmon. Why is this important? It's important because at a time when the state and federal government is spending millions of dollars to recover salmon, we should at least be looking at what potentially adding a new pollutant, an additional pollutant, and increasing the threats to salmon would do. I'm not saying that if fluoride was great for your teeth and horrible for salmon, that your body may not say, hey, you know what, the kids' teeth are worth it. But what I think is important is to at least make that assessment, to begin to look at that issue. A couple of the documents before you. I attached this because this is the type of thing I look at all the time. I review Clean Water Act pollution permits when they want to dump something into the river. This is one for Idaho. If you flip to page 6 on my numbering, it kind of lays out the statements that fluoride levels as low as 2 milligrams per liter have been shown to have lethal effects to many species of aquatic life. However, this occurred in waters with very low hardness. Well, guess what? We in the Northwest have very low hardness. They say less than 100 milligrams per liter is a measurement of hardness. We got about 54 on somewhere like the Columbia. Going down to citation B,
A question.
Yes.
In some of our feeder streams, it's even lower than that, isn't it?
Yes.
Like the McKenzie River, for example?
You know, I don't know the specific hardness, but I know that definitely is my understanding is that it gets softer as it goes down further into larger streams. It gets hard. The hardness increases.
Right. So McKenzie would be harder than the feeder streams.
Softer.
Columbia would be harder than the feeder streams.
Correct. And that means that in the feeder streams there would be higher susceptibility. The point is, in drinking water, the target level, and we're dealing with all small numbers, one part per million. What this is saying is that at one-fifth of that level, one-fifth the level we would use in drinking water, it's showing toxic effects on aquatic life. Now, that may trigger some thoughts in your head that if something's toxic for salmon at one-fifth the concentration that's in drinking water, what's it do to us at 500% greater concentration? I'm not going to get into that, but this does, and B and C goes on. EPA in this permit said that the safe level chronic toxicity level was 0.38. Again, that's less than half of the level that we target in drinking water. The next article, I'm not going to, page 7, only a title, Willamette Week Would Love, Stone Salmon Pissed Environmentalists. Excuse my French, but it is a quick primer. It's got quotes from OSU chemists. It's got quote from National Marine Fisheries Service toxicologist who says, fluoride is pretty toxic, and the softer the water, the more toxic it is. Goes on to talk about why adding fluoridation to the water last time this mandatory bill came up is a real concern. I know that Lynn Campbell provided a citation of the Canadian water quality document. It's a pretty careful review. Their ended up conclusion was that their recommended water quality standard was 0.12 parts per million. Wow, that's almost one-tenth of the concentration that we're at is actually in drinking water. I am not a fluoride expert, but one of the things that absolutely struck me on this is I never knew where fluoride even came from. And what I stumbled on pretty early was a piece written by Thomas Reeves, who's the National Fluoridation Engineer, head of the Center for Disease Control's fluoride effort. He explains, quote, all of the fluoride chemicals used in the U.S. for water fluoridation, sodium fluoride, sodium fluorosilicate, fluorosilicic acid, are byproducts of the phosphate fertilizer industry. Wow, we're putting industrial byproducts in the water. That was a shock to me. And what concerned me more is when I went on to actually say, well, what else is in the water? Are we getting pure fluoride? Is that all? Or are there maybe contaminants from the industrial process or just other things that we get when we get fluoride? And on page 2, Mr. Reeves answered that. He said, according to NSF tests, which is the water agency which essentially tests fluoride, tests water additives, by no means an environmental group, a water industry strongly ties with the water providers, describes arsenic concentrations of 0.43 parts per billion. Wow, 0.43 parts per billion sounds pretty small until you know the EPA safety level for arsenic, the level at which U.S. EPA, after extensive study, said the safe level, the only level that we can say is safe for arsenic exposure is zero. That doesn't mean we don't get arsenic already in our environment, but when we're adding it to the water, it's something that we should at least think about. Because when I go to the next thing, I looked a little further at NSF and see what this is, the standards foundation that actually reviews. You go to page 15. It turns out it's not just arsenic that would come if we required fluoride in the water. It's a list of 10 or more other heavy metals. Antimony, arsenic, barium, beryllium, cadmium, chromium, copper, and lead. I said lead? Lead's one of those things, like arsenic, the EPA has said there is no safe level. And whether it's the New England Journal of Medicine or any other researcher, the accepted, peer-reviewed, scientifically proven knowledge on lead right now says don't add any more. Because every bit you add, there's a direct correlation with decreased IQ. Wow. We're going to help pour. I will try.
Okay. Going to have to, you know.
Can I have 30 seconds to wrap up?
You can have 30 seconds.
Thank you. What this said to me was that this is a little more complicated issue than I first thought. I asked a few of the doctors here this morning who are going to be testifying, and actually Dr. Lace, who did testify on behalf of the Oregon Pediatric Society, the Oregon Medical Association, I showed him the list of toxics and said, have you looked at this? Do you know about this? Have you considered whether this might be bad for the very kids you're trying to help? And he said, no. And that concerns me. And so one of the things I'd ask is every dentist or doctor who gets up here and testifies that fluoride is healthy and it's safe and it's a benefit, maybe they should let the committee know whether or not they've looked at this arsenic data and explain to me how you can put high levels of these toxics in the water along with fluoride, and that isn't something we should at least be talking about, let alone form a foundation for whether or not this bill should move forward. The last thing I'll point out is just a study by Masters and Copeland in the Journal of Neurotoxicology, peer-reviewed, not a quack journal. It actually found higher blood lead levels in kids in fluoridated communities than non. Check it out. I hope you do some research on your own. Again, I appreciate the time. I think we think this is a big environment. This is a public health issue as well, not just for salmon, but from the perspective of kids' health and the amount of toxic which goes into their body as an indirect effect of fluoridation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. At this point, we have two other gentlemen, Jeff Green from Citizens for Safe Drinking Water and Gordon Martin, and I believe this is from the TV Water District. Could both of you?
My name is Jeffrey, and I appreciate the courtesy, but I'm going to be here for the duration, and I was actually asked to kind of fill in the gaps, and only you only have 3 minutes for other people to testify, so you can put them in the bottom or someplace.
Okay. Fine.
Thank you.
How about Gordon Martin?
I might add that I probably mismarked the box.
Oh, okay.
I meant to put him within.
All right. Thank you very much. At this point, then, we will go in some order as they were signed up. We have Mary Martin from the Oregon Toxics Alliance, Bill Osmondson, Mary O'Brien, I beg your pardon.
That's okay.
Bill Osmondson, and Dr. John Barry. If the three of you could come up, and we'll... And we'll start off with Ms. O'Brien. I beg your pardon.
Chair Jensen, Water Committee, thank you. I'm Mary O'Brien, testifying as a citizen, a scientist with a doctorate in botany, and a 22-year advocate for alternatives to toxics use. And I only want to mention two of the many problems associated with HB 2025. And one of them is one that was just developed well by Brent Foster, this being the fact that the medication of Oregon water supplies would not use pharmaceutical-grade fluoride, but industrial fluoride waste. Thus, HB 2025 is analogous to legislating that all adults, whether they are already on blood-thinning medications or not, will have to take an aspirin a day, and that the aspirin will have to come be made out of industrial waste laced with arsenic and lead. This isn't good preventive medicine, it isn't good medical practice, and it isn't good public policy. Even though these silica fluoride wastes are used in 91% of U.S. fluoridation mass medication programs, as of 2000, no animal or human toxicity studies on possible toxic effects in humans or animals of these industrial waste silica fluorides were known to the U.S. EPA. And I have studies here that I can pass out. For those of you who want those, quoting that. Catherine Bradley spoke of fluoride. She didn't speak of silica fluoride waste. She spoke of the absence of evidence of fluoride harm to human health. She did not speak to the absence of testing of silica fluorides. And as Brent Foster mentioned, in 2000, four researchers examined over 150,000 blood tests taken from children 0 to 6 years of age in communities that had the silica fluoride waste in their water and those that didn't. And those in the communities that did have the fluoridated water supplies had a higher blood level of uptake of lead in their body. Apparently, the silica fluorides do not dissociate to the degree that sodium fluoride does, and apparently facilitates the uptake of lead. And as you know, there is no safe level of lead in children. And then I was going to mention also the issue that one part per million fluoride medication is toxic to salmon. I'll just go into the details of one of the ways this was found. In 1979 to 82, fisheries biologists found salmon failing to migrate upstream at normal speeds or survive at normal rates below the John Day River Dam. At first, they altered the water levels. It didn't change the problem. They began to look at pollutants because there's an aluminum smelting plant right upstream, found, quote, high levels of fluoride, which were about 0.7 parts per million. They then did studies in another stream where they put one flume with sodium, laboratory-grade sodium fluoride in one flume and nothing in the other, and looked at the salmon. They avoided the one with the sodium fluoride, and they would switch which days, which flumes they had this in, and they, out of this, out of 578 tests, they concluded that this is toxic to, fluoride is toxic to salmon at 0.5 milligrams per liter, which is half of what we would be putting into the water.
Could you wrap up in about 30 seconds?
Yes, that's fine. With my last 30 seconds, HB 2025 is an extraordinarily clumsy, toxic, socially and ecologically irresponsible way to reduce dental cavities in children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
I'll pass these.
Please, would you just give them to staff here and they'll get them out to you.
Mr. Chair, could I put a question on the record that somebody in your testimony might want to respond to? I don't really care who. But with regards to the argument about the salmon,
yes.
One of the things that should be noted is that when water goes through a city system, it does not flow directly into the river without going through some kind of a process before it gets there. So understanding that waste is removed from water through the wastewater treatment sewer system, I would like to know if any tests have been done with regards to the outfall from wastewater treatment plants that are flowing into whatever river they might be flowing into, and what the measurable fluoride from fluoridated communities has been in the outfall from their wastewater treatment plants.
That would be a very specific question to someone that would have
I say that, Mr. Chair, because we've had two situations now, or two folks that are testifying that they're arguing that water placed in a community's water system is going to be toxic to salmon. I want to know what the measurable amount of fluoride going through the system coming out the other end is once it's flushed through the system.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, if I might add to Representative Kremel's question, it seems to me there's one more issue in addition, and that is once you get the outflow from the sewer treatment plant diluted into the river, what do we have left? I'm a bit confused about what the numbers mean. Certainly a number, for example, like half of the amount that you would add to the water supply in the river being toxic doesn't suggest to me, at least, that the effluent from a treatment plant after water had been fluoridated would come anywhere near that amount in the river. But I'm interested in hearing what the experts can tell us about that issue, and I think it's in aid of Representative Kremel's question.
I thank both of you gentlemen for that question. If I might, though, I probably would prefer to deal with these questions in a work session when we as a group are involved in more in the discussion, because we've got a lot of people that are here to talk to us, and I'd like to hear what they have to say. And I'd ask everybody on the committee, if you have these kind of, as we go through this, running questions, that we not lose track of those, so that when we do get to, if we get to that point, that we'll be able to deal with them and deal with them adequately. Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Representative Jensen. And just a rhetorical addition as well. If the concern really is that about the fish in particular, that the substance will be getting into nature, I guess, is it possible to filter out the fluoride before it becomes the effluent that mixes with river water and stuff? So just as an addition.
Okay. Representative Jensen, I will get information to you. My understanding is that the treatment facilities are not designed to and do not remove the fluoride.
Well, that wasn't my point. My point was, can we filter it out? Is that a possibility?
Okay, Bill.
Thank you very much, Chairman Jensen and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Bill Osmondson. I'm a dentist. I have a master's in public health. I'm currently working in Lake Oswego. You do have a little handout that was given to you here. It has my letterhead on it. I currently work with oral facial pain, TMJ disorders, headaches, complete small makeovers as an aesthetic dentist. In other words, I treat fluorosis to a big extent. I am director and founder of the Institute for Comprehensive Dental Studies, teaching postgraduate courses to dentists, and I'm licensed to practice dentistry in the five states. As recent as 5 years ago, I was a supporter of water fluoridation. I also testified for cities on fluoridation. Upon request and with adequate patient education, we'll still prescribe fluoride. I'm considered an expert witness both in dentistry and in public health. With further evaluation of our current scientific evidence and closer review of historical studies, I no longer support water fluoridation. Weighing the benefits, hazards, and the many unknowns of fluoridated water, it is my opinion as an expert that water fluoridation at this time is not in the best interest of the public's health. As a general dentist, I have taken needles and stuck them in your children and grandchildren. I've drilled in your children's teeth, or our children's teeth. I've seen them cry, and I've cried in my heart also. Doing surgery on a child is not easy. I want to prevent these problems. However, we need to take everything in perspective and look at it closely. This is a controversial issue, and there's a ton of information. You will never get through it all. If you spent 8 hours a day for the next 5 years, you would not digest the material that is available for you on fluoride. It is impossible. You need expert witnesses to explain their opinions on it, and then it is only their opinion. This is a huge topic. There's a lot of politics involved. We as dentists generally look at the issue from a dental standpoint and the preventing of having big surgeries on your children. But that is only one perspective. We're looking at it from one area. From a public health standpoint, it's seen as another area. From a cosmetic dentist later in life and trying to take care of the problems of fluorosis, that's a different issue. From the neurology, epidemiology issues, it's huge. There are two main standards of scientific evidence. One is, does a drug affect the disease? And that takes a certain scientific statistical analysis that, yes, it does to a certain degree affect the disease. It's a complete different standard when we say, what are the side effects that this drug causes? There's no money to study that kind of a problem. A manufacturer is going to do the testing to prove that they can sell their product because they want to sell their product and it benefits their product in sales. They're not going to do a lot of research in showing how this is a problem and is going to decrease sales. You watch on television or have all these advertisements of pharmaceutical drugs and they'll say, and this may cause diarrhea and digestion. They aren't saying that just because it improves sales. They're saying that for legal liability reasons. Okay? So the scientific method for looking at side effects is really quite different than looking at whether a drug works or not. Dentists are experts of the teeth and the gums. From a teeth standpoint, I think fluoride may help. I lived where there was and there wasn't fluoride. I've worked with people in areas where they did not have fluoride, and I used to kind of guess, okay, this person is from up that river because of the amount of decay in their mouth. And frequently I was correct. So I think fluoride may have an effect.
We are in recess.
our House Water Committee after a some almost 15-minute delay. Compliments of the administration of the Capitol building here. And we have Dr. Bill Osmundson has been talking to us. And Bill, I think you're probably have 15 minutes now plus your time. Could you wrap up in 30 seconds, please?
Okay. The testimony was pretty hot. That's why we had to have a fire on. I want to look at at Floyd from a global issue. The purpose of fluoridation is to try to reduce decay. However, if I could use an illustration, suppose we had a disease called smoker's lung cancer, and we chose to get a product that would prevent this smoker's lung cancer. And we said, we're going to put it in the water system, and we're going to inoculate everybody to prevent smoker's lung cancer. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Now, there might be some side effects, there might be some problems, but let's just inoculate everybody. And that's what we're doing here. We're looking at water fluoridation doesn't help adults, really. What it does is the child during the developmental time. So there's a small target population, and fluoride isn't the only way to prevent decay. Most of my instructors, pediatric instructors, said I can prevent decay, and I've agreed with them in practice. We can prevent decay with simply getting rid of the garbage in our diets. A little bit of brushing and flossing. In fact, you don't even need clean teeth as a child, as long as... I hope nobody repeats me on that. But you wouldn't have to if you had a great diet. Diet is everything, and it doesn't have to have fluoride in it. So we're not talking about the only method of preventing decay here. We're talking about preventing decay so that kids can go out and eat garbage. And that's our society right now. We want a pill to fix ourselves. We want a pill. Just let me live my lifestyle the way I want to live it. Eat all the garbage I can and take the pill. The problem is it doesn't take care of diabetes, doesn't take care of periodontal disease, doesn't take care of obesity, doesn't take care of a lot of the other problems that the bad diet is causing. So the little fix that we're trying to do here from a global view is not focused correctly from a public health standpoint. We need to spend our time and our dollars preventing not only decay, but let's, if possible, work on cleaning up some of the diet. You'll take care of as much or more of the decay by improving the diet than you ever will with fluoride. And fluoride is, like I was saying before, is highly controversial. You can spend the rest of your lives looking at it and you'll never come to a definitive conclusion on it with 100% certainty. You get an expert from one area that says one thing or another. In the end of my testimony here, I have some unanswered questions that I think are very serious, and I'd like you to look at those. There are some concerns I have that are mentioned there, but if you have any questions, I would entertain those.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. This point, we have Dr. John Barry.
My name is John Barry. I want to thank you for allowing me to say something. I'll attempt to be terse. I'm a physician and pediatrician. I'm further involved in a number of environmental issues. I'm a member of the executive committee of the state chapter of the Sierra Club. I've been involved with the Physicians for Social Responsibility and a number of other organizations. I want to speak for fluoridation. I've been involved in pediatrics in Oregon since 1957. That's close to 50 years. And during that time, I've had the opportunity to see the evolution of the use of fluoride in the state. I practiced almost all of that time in Benton County in Corvallis. Corvallis has had water with fluoride added to it for almost 40 years. I think I can attest to the fact that the kids' dental health has improved immeasurably during this 40-year period of time. And just by looking in the kids' mouths, I could pretty much tell you whether they came from a home that had city water or whether they came from a home that did not have city water, mostly on the basis of their dental hygiene and dental condition. In the 40 years I've practiced in Corvallis, as I say, during that time the water has been fluoridated, I've not seen any untoward effects of the presence of fluoride in the water, neither on the population nor on the environment. And so I would hope that you people will support fluoridation, and that's all I've got to say.
Thank you very kindly, Doctor, and appreciate all of your testimony. With that, listeners, we'll go to the next group or panel. And we are trying to bring you up at three at a time. It will expedite the kind of our whole process. We have Andrew Harris, MD, Michael Franson, I believe, is on that, and then Ann Durant. Are all three of
Michael Franson?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And you'd be Dr. Harris?
I am.
Would you proceed, please?
Chairman Jensen, members of the committee, my name's Andrew Harris. I'm a physician in Salem. I wish there were good, well-controlled, peer-reviewed studies of fluoridation of drinking water, but there simply aren't. This is the reason that there is so much misinformation and confusion on this subject. Conventional wisdom is that fluorides help prevent caries of the teeth. While I believe this is true, I would recommend against fluoridation of drinking water for two reasons. When fluorides were first added to drinking water in the 1940s and 1950s, the additive typically was sodium fluoride. There are now over 90% of fluorides used in drinking water are in the form of hydrofluorosilicic acid and sodium silica fluoride from industrial waste. According to the CDC, less than 10% of fluorides used in drinking water are in the form of sodium fluoride. Well, both hydrofluorosilicic acid and sodium silica fluoride are derived from pollution scrubbing systems, primarily in the manufacture of phosphate fertilizers, as you've heard. These scrubbers are designed to prevent the release of toxic fluorides into the air and into the environment. The chemicals are very toxic, and the effluent containing these chemicals is classified as hazardous waste. And cannot be discharged into the oceans, rivers, or landfills, or allowed to escape in the air because it can harm plants, animals, and humans. It must be disposed of at a licensed hazardous waste facility unless it can be sold to municipalities to put them in their drinking water. Now, I think that's really quite extraordinary that this same hazardous waste, which is untreated, can be added to drinking water. Despite assurances by proponents of water fluoridation that the effluent is safe, according to the EPA, there is not one study of the safety of either hydrofluorosilicic acid or sodium silica fluoride on health and behavior. The effluent from the manufacturer of phosphate fertilizers also contains arsenic, lead, and other heavy metals. And we now know that even minute amounts of these toxic substances, just a few molecules, can have adverse effects on fetal and early development. According to an article in the Journal of Medicine in 2003, there is no safe level of lead exposure. Well, the issue of fluoridating water is not about adding a pure reagent-grade fluoride purchased from a chemical supply house. The effluent from industrial scrubbers contains known carcinogens and neurotoxins. The chemicals have been implicated in learning disabilities, attention deficit, and aggressive and delinquent behavior, just to name a few. One has to ask, why would anyone want to expose the general population, particularly fetuses and newborns, to toxic chemicals? Well, my second point is that developments in recent years have found that the primary benefits on fluorides on teeth is not from systemic fluoride ingestion, as in drinking water, but rather from the topical application of fluoride. Today, fluorides are contained in a great variety of products, for example, toothpaste, mouthwashes, fruit juices, soda pop, processed foods, and cereals. In view of the time, I'll sum up my comments here. As a physician who's looking at this from a public health standpoint, fluoride additives are not needed because they are already ubiquitous in foods and drinks today. They are a very toxic substance. Fluorides rate between lead and arsenic in level of toxicity. They bioaccumulate, as we've heard, in the environment, affecting the reproductive cycles of fish and animals. And the fluorides currently being used today in municipal drinking water do derive from industrial waste. With so many concerns and so many questions, I would ask you to follow the advice of Hippocrates, first do no harm. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Mr. Chair. One brief one. You noted that these substances bioaccumulate in the environment. Is that also true in the human body, or do they tend to be passed on through?
I believe they do bioaccumulate in the human body.
And do we have any studies about the effects of bioaccumulation in the human body? Do you know?
I can't answer that specifically.
Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Franson.
Thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name is Michael Framson. I'm from Medford, Oregon, and I've been specifically asked to by the what you have in front of you is testimony from three physicians who would have moved mountains to be at this hearing today, but were given insufficient advance notice, and they are very concerned about this issue. The Rogue Valley has been looking at this issue for over 4 years. And once the issue of fluoridation came up, a number of physicians had looked at some preliminary data, and they were so concerned that they invited Dr. William Hersey to come out and do a presentation to the physicians of the Rogue Valley. And at this point in time, I can tell you there are only questions with lots of unresolved answers. John Walker and John Bronner and Nick Dienel worked late into the night to get their testimony to me, and I brought it up to you this morning. I will read excerpts of their testimony, and I won't read any of my own, because this is the people you need to hear from. I'm going to read to you first from John Walker's testimony. As practicing physician with almost 30 years of clinical experience and 12 years of medical education and training, it is only in the last several years that I have taken the time to study fluoridation in depth. Like many of my colleagues, I assumed that the science behind fluoridation was solid. No medical therapy is beyond scientific discussion or debate. Fluoridation probably epitomizes a drug treatment far in excess beyond the medical science that supports its valid use as a public population-based health policy. It is not only the recent credible studies, research, and new awareness of fluoride's inherent toxicity that raise grave and serious questions about the safety of fluoridation, but the decades of fluoridation research that have yielded studies of poor to moderate quality. The scientific underpinnings of fluoridation are highly questionable based on a dearth of reliable evidence. Therefore, as physicians taking an oath to first do no harm, we are concerned that water fluoridation violates the standards of medical practice and turns a precautionary principle upside down. As physicians, we find it medically unacceptable that whole populations are being subjected to uncontrolled dosages of a non-toxic chemical contaminated with lead and arsenic through their water supply, regardless of each patient's age, health, or history. As physicians, we are deeply troubled that we have yet to see good outcome studies on fluoridation safety, and that the current scientific evidence exposes its efficacy as unreliable. Massive questions about adverse health effects are unresolved, both because obvious health studies have never been done, and growing numbers of peer-reviewed studies show causal relationships to a variety of adverse health effects from chronic fluoride ingestion at levels found in optimally fluoridated drinking water. All this leads to our concern that it would be ethically improper to apply fluoridation as a prophylactic treatment. As physicians, we are strongly opposed to fluoridation in HB 2025. On this day, January 17th, I have polled my office concerning this letter and discuss this thoroughly with all present. Absent today are one physician and one nurse practitioner. Of the seven of us present, only one favors fluoridation, and the six others oppose HB 2025. The physicians are Paul F. Schweinitz, MD, Gregory F. Winters, MD, Peter W. Addisman, MD, and myself. Also opposed are nurse practitioners Lois Haunch, FNP, and Jeannie Buell, FNP. I do not know that this reflects a trend of opinion in the medical society, but such strong opposition in my office I find reasonable given what we know. In the not-too-distant future, we believe that fluoride in the drinking water would join the ranks of other good ideas, many supported at one time by physicians, including lead in gasoline, asbestos in insulation, mercury in vaccinations, DDT, DES, HRT, and cigarette smoking. As physicians, we encourage the members of the Water Committee to exercise due diligence in understanding the extraordinary complexity of fluoridation, which has potentially such serious health and environmental ramifications. We further encourage the members to employ the precautionary principle by acting on the more than sufficient evidence available showing probability of harm rather than waiting for the inevitable onslaught of evidence of fluoride's previously unrecognized adverse effects. Respectfully, John Walker, MD. And I think I'm so nervous, I don't know if I can read the other two. But let me say this. Nick Dienels, whose testimony is also before you, when I first approached Nick Dina with information about fluoride, I just asked him, what do you know about fluoride? And his response was, fluoride is good as apple pie in America. And it is probably Nick Dina who has been such a strong advocate for physicians to really examine this evidence and don't base what you assume to be the case. Certainly don't base what the spin on fluoridation is, because it's the science, it are the studies that are incriminating fluoridation. I'm going to jump to the second paragraph. Clearly, fluoridation of municipal water systems is being promoted to reduce dental cavities. The use of any substance to heal or cure medical conditions fall under the regulation of the FDA. Yet fluoridation of water, fluoride specifically, has never been reviewed or approved by the FDA to reduce dental cavities. Furthermore, pharmaceutical-grade sodium fluoride is generally not used for water fluoridation. Hydrofluorosilicic acid, a toxic waste product formed in the manufacture of phosphate fertilizers, is the most frequently used substance for water fluoridation. Hydrofluorosilicic acid is often contaminated with heavy metals such as arsenic, lead, barium, cadmium, and mercury. All these substances are known toxins to humans. No regulations require rigorous testing for the purity of these products used in water fluoridation. As a physician, I believe we should first and foremost do no harm, especially when implementing widespread public health policies such as municipal water fluoridation. This policy is flawed for many reasons. Number one, the benefit of fluoride in preventing cavities is topical, not by systemic ingestion of fluoridated water. Number two, the dose of fluoride is not regulated because it is dependent upon the amount of water an individual consumes. Number three, substances used for fluoridation are contaminated with heavy metals, known to be toxic in even small amounts. Number four, the amount of fluoride in our environment has increased so much over the past 50 years that most of the population, even in unfluoridated municipalities, is already ingesting over 1 milligram of fluoride from foods. Number five, individuals with medical conditions such as renal failure or diabetes will be exposed to fluoride, which may worsen their medical conditions. Number six, water fluoridation is not a magic bullet to prevent dental caries. A well-balanced diet, good dental hygiene, and visiting a dentist are more important in achieving good dental hygiene. 20% of the population accounts for 80% of dental caries. Generally, these individuals are indigent and do not have good education as to a healthy diet or good dental hygiene. This group certainly has limited access to dentists. Number seven, none of the studies performed over the past 50 years have carefully examined and searched for unexpected long-term adverse consequences of mass fluoridation systems. These possible adverse effects include issues of mental function, such as ADHD and antisocial behavior, rare forms of bone cancer, and arthritis, to name a few. I'm going to skip a paragraph here. Many scientists, from Nobel Prize laureates, have very serious concerns regarding the widespread use of municipal water fluoridation. Less than 2% of Europe's population have fluoridated water. Many European nations have discontinued or banned the practice of water fluoridation. Until we have well-done, long-term studies on the safety and efficacy of water fluoridation, we should not expose our population to these substances. This is especially true since over 90% of these substances used for municipal water fluoridation are derived from the toxic byproducts of the fertilizer industry. I urge this committee to reject House Bill 2025 on the basis that municipalities are effectively practicing medicine by adding fluoride to the water with the intent of reducing dental caries. This action violates all tenets of medical practice by not giving the individual a choice after informed consent regarding the risks and benefits of ingesting a substance added to the drinking water. Signed, Nicholas H. Dino, M.D. I'll conclude the testimony. John Bronner, a surgeon from Medford, also has written testimony here, and I know I've taken up more time than you would have wished, but I thank you that you heard from these physicians.
Thank you, Mr. Franson. We did allow colleagues a little more time on that because there were a number of people who were making presentations with this, and you do have all of this in your written material, so we'll proceed from that. Anne Durant, is that correct?
Yes. I'm Anne Durant. I'm a chiropractor, and I am representing Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic. As soon as I'm done, I will bring up our ODOC, Oregon Doctors of Chiropractic position paper on fluoride, and my testimony today. The position paper is broader, covers more concerns. I'm going to limit myself to one concern today, and that is that fluoride is added to the water as a medical treatment, although it is not pharmaceutical grade. We can all agree that it is added as a medical treatment. Even if it were undeniably effective for that purpose, I do not understand why, in the case of putting fluoride compounds into drinking water, the most basic rules of medical practice are suspended. We know that pharmaceuticals have undesirable side effects in addition to the desired effect. So when a physician decides that it's appropriate to prescribe a drug, he will diligently monitor their patient in an attempt to prescribe for them a specific medication at an optimal dose for the shortest time to get the desired effect with the least possible side effects. How can a physician conscientiously suspend this practice ever? Can it make sense for a doctor to expose every person in their practice to an uncontrolled dose of a pharmaceutical agent from the time they're born until they die? What makes it okay for government to do this? Some fluoride proponents answer that fluoride is a nutrient. I just read that in the Portland Monthly last month. It is not a nutrient. There is no essential function for fluoride in the human body. Rather, it is listed by the U.S. Agency for Toxic Substances and the Disease Registry as among the top 20 of 275 substances that pose the most significant threat to human health. Dr. James Sumner, who is a Nobel Prize winner for his work on enzyme chemistry, has advised caution with regard to fluoridation, saying, "Everybody knows fluorine and fluoride are very poisonous substances. We use them in enzyme chemistry to poison enzymes, those vital agents in the body." The Nobel Prize medicine recipient in medicine and physiology for the year 2000 was Dr. Arvid Carlson of Sweden. He recommended rejection of fluoridation in Sweden in part because, he said, it is a question of applying a pharmacologically active substance to an entire population. As chiropractors, we make nutritional recommendations to patients, but we still would not advocate the use of drinking water supplies for delivery of any vitamins and minerals, even though these are vastly safe compared to fluoride. It is simply inappropriate with respect to individual needs, dosage, and quality control. Fluoride advocates answer that the dose of fluoride delivered in the drinking water is too small for concerns about toxicity. In fact, the dose of fluoride one receives depends on how much water they drink and what their other exposures are in the intake of fluoride residues in foods and beverages from other pharmaceuticals and from dental products. The presence of fluorosis in two-thirds of children in fluoridated communities demonstrates that they have been overdosed. There are published peer-reviewed studies correlating the effects of fluoridated water with increased lead uptake into the blood, thyroid disease, increased hip fracture, neurological problems, osteosarcoma, and other disease. At what point do we practice precaution when there are so many warning signals? The American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Dental Association recommend a daily fluoride dosage from birth to 6 months of 0 milligrams of fluoride. How can we give a baby 0 milligrams of fluoride when it's in the water? From 6 months to 3 years, 0.25 milligrams are recommended. That's the amount in one cup of water. Does that matter? The elderly, diabetics, people with cardiovascular disease, and the malnourished are most vulnerable to harm from fluoride. How are they considered when their water has fluoridation chemicals added? With the exception of Australia, New Zealand, and a small part of the UK, the United States is alone in thinking that water fluoridation is an acceptable practice. 4 years ago when we were here, it was thought by somebody that was testifying for fluoridation that maybe in Europe they were just backwards. But European governments and their health ministries have taken stands and made statements about why they don't fluoridate. Here are some of them. France does not add fluoride due to ethical as well as medical considerations. Germany argues against fluoridation due to the problematic nature of compulsive medication. Luxembourg says drinking water isn't the suitable way for medicinal treatment. Finland says the individual's right to drinking water without additional chemicals used for the medication. They talk about the individual's right to drinking water without additional chemicals used for the medication of limited population groups. Belgium says drinking water, it is not its task to deliver medicinal treatment to people. Denmark says, we are pleased to inform you that according to the Danish Ministry of the Environment and Energy, toxic fluorides have never been added to the public water supplies. Austria says toxic fluorides have never been added to the public water supplies. From the Czech, yes?
Could we sum up?
Okay.
There. Thank you.
The Czech Republic says fluoridation is considered uneconomical, unecological, unethical, and toxicologically and physiologically debatable. It is important to mention that data from the World Health Organization shows a trend of decreased tooth decay from 1960 to the present and a similar rate of tooth decay in countries throughout the world, whether they practice fluoridation or not. If you have any doubt about the safety, efficacy, or ethics of mandating fluoridation, please keep studying it. Please do not rush to mandate that this state and its communities spend their stretched finances to do something we will regret later. In effect, please do not put yourself in the position of prescribing an uncontrolled dose of a medicament of an uncontrolled quality on Oregon citizens. Let's keep water as safe, clean, and pure as possible.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Ladies and gentlemen, as you can see, we've got about 17 minutes left, and we are a little better than a third of the way through people who are here to testify. And what we're going to do is we're going to post and continue these public hearings on Wednesday, that would be the 26th, I believe. What I'm going to ask at this point, as I call the names of the people the way they're signed up, if you can come on next Wednesday, it's not inconvenient for you, I'd ask that you, raise your hand and wave at me, and I'll call the next one on down the line so we can try to get everybody in that can only be here today. So, Sandra Duffy, Lois, is it Barron?
Barron, I can come next Wednesday.
Okay. Sue Dan, Sanzi Schrader? You can come.
No, I
cannot
come next week.
Come.
I'm Sandra Duffy. I need to be here today.
If you can't come next week, please, come on up. I've got, is it Suzanne Mallon? Okay. Sandra Duffy? Okay. Please, and try for 2 or 3 minutes and summarize your... We appreciate it very much.
I read pretty well, and so if people are here and they can sort of give
good point,
their feelings without having to read 5 pages of testimony, I'd be happy to take a look at wherever they leave. Thank you.
If you have written testimony,
the committee. For the record, I'm Sandra Duffy, Lake Oswego. I'm an assistant county attorney at Multnomah County, and I'm here to testify in my personal capacity only. I am opposed to House Bill 2025. I have here a new book that was published in the fall of this year, and it is a matter of greatest urgency that the Water Committee Chair and the members read this book. I have provided 8 copies to the clerk. This book is called The Fluoride Deception by investigative reporter Christopher Bryson, which was... this book summarizes 60 years of fluoride uses in steel, aluminum, phosphate, gasoline, uranium enrichment, refrigerants, and plastics. And he shows how the necessities of World War II blinded the public health regulators to medical reports of occupational hazards from the fluoride exposures. He contends that Americans drink fluoridated water because the government and industry leaders wanted a benign use for industrial fluoride waste. He obtained access to once secret industry and government documents which support his contention. The book paints a picture of coercion and fraud used to ensure that fluoride would continue to be used by industry without limits despite the threat to public health. In 1950, the American Dental Association and the Public Health Service worked to begin fluoridation in the United States. At that time, the director of the Public Health Service was Oscar Ewing, an ex-Alcoa aluminum lawyer. And if you heard my list earlier, fluoride is very important in the production of aluminum. Ewing hired Edward Bernays, who has been called, quote, the most influential public relations master of the 20th century, end of quote, to conduct a nationwide sales campaign for water fluoridation to American public. Bryson interviewed Bernays in 1993 when he was 102 years old. Bernays told Bryson that selling fluoride was mere child's play. Quote, you can get practically any idea accepted. If doctors are in favor, the public is willing to accept it. Because a doctor is an authority to most people, regardless of how much he knows or doesn't know, end of quote. Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud and clearly knew something about psychology. The book is meticulously documented with over 115 pages of reference notes. And though you may never have heard of Christopher Bryson, the book contains a foreword by well-known author Theo Colburn. She wrote, Our Stolen Future, Are We Threatening Our Fertility, Intelligence, and Survival? A scientific detective story published in 1996. That book sets out the destructive effects of persistent organic pesticides on the developing fetus in utero. In her foreword, she states that certainly the evidence Bryson unearthed in this book begs for immediate attention by those responsible for public health. The evidence Bryson presents in this book should cause those charged with protecting public health to demand answers about the developmental, the reproductive, and functional role of fluorine in all living organisms. Evidence has recently surfaced that prenatal exposure to certain fluorinated chemicals is dangerous, often fatal at high doses. In even extremely low doses, exposure can undermine the development of the brain, the thyroid, and the metabolic system. In conclusion, House Bill 2025 will mandate that a contaminated, unapproved drug be placed in the drinking water systems of most Oregonians. There are no studies to support the safety or efficacy used in 90% of the drinking water systems. Until such studies are published, I urge you not to publish this, to pass this bill out of committee. And as I said, a copy of the book is available for each of you. I urge you very, very strongly to read it or to assign it to an assistant if you don't have the time, because I understand that time is very short at this period in your life. But this contains absolutely essential information for making a decision on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sandra.
Can I just ask her?
You may. Staff has a question for you, Sam. Mm-hmm.
You left a copy of the book. There's a bag over there with eight copies, so one for each member, plus for the administrator as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Is it Lois? Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Jensen, committee members. My name is Sue Sanzi-Shadell. I am a public health dental hygienist who has experience in community-based dental prevention or dental disease prevention programs, particularly fluoride. I'm here today speaking for myself and also for the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association. And as you might guess, I am here to speak in favor of House Bill 2025. I encourage you to support a statewide mandate for fluoridation, as the benefits of statewide fluoridation cross all jurisdictions. The benefits cross all ages. I must disagree with some of the previous speakers on the benefits of fluoridation. Even though fluoridated water is ingested, one of the major modes of or vehicles for benefit is topical, as well as by ingesting, it therefore benefits all of us. All us baby boomers are getting up there. We've got a little gum recession. We're now getting root decay. People who grow up in fluoridated communities have fluoridated access to fluoridated water, have 50% less root decay. A statewide mandate focuses attention on the need to view effective disease prevention from a broad perspective. This mandate would provide the tooth decay prevention benefits to the vast majority of Oregonians, particularly those who are most vulnerable, our elderly, the disabled, homeless, those who have come to our country having grown up in cultures where knowledge about prevention is very limited at best. Fluoridation is the most cost-effective strategy for reducing the oral disease burden and the disparity found in our state. For every dollar spent on fluoridating a community water supply, $38 are saved in dental treatment costs. Texas, at the request of their legislature, conducted a study in 2000 to determine the savings in Medicaid dollars for treating children in fluoridated and non-fluoridated communities. A $15 to $19 per child per year savings was found for children treated in fluoridated communities. I have heard it suggested that Oregon should look for alternative strategies to fluoridation for preventing tooth decay. Although there is about a 20% reduction in tooth decay with an elementary school-based fluoride program, it's not good enough. While fluoridation is beneficial for all ages, fluoride tablet programs only reach those children who have reached elementary school age, which is long after the benefits of fluoride are needed for protection of baby teeth, and it never reaches the rest of the population. The cost of providing the fluoride tablets alone in a school-based program are about $1.25 per child per year. It is the cost for staff training, delivering, monitoring, quality, and evaluating the programs, which bring the cost closer to $3 per child. And this, of course, does not count for the cost of some 1,200 school teachers who administer the program. I'm involved with an early childhood cavity prevention program. We see over 1,000 babies between 9 and 36 months of age. Parent education and topical fluoride applications are provided in this program. 44% of these babies between the ages of 9 and 36 months have already experienced tooth decay in Oregon. General dentists are not trained to treat babies in their offices because of the $1,500 to $4,500 price tag to treat babies in the hospital by a specialist. Many uninsured babies and their families live with chronic pain, much of which could have been avoided with access to fluoridated water. Prevention is the best strategy to prevent all disease, and fluoridation is the best prevention strategy for this infectious disease for the entire community and the entire state. I request your support for House Bill 2025. Thank you.
Thank you very kindly. We have testimony. Suzanne?
Yes. Excuse me. My name is Suzanne Mayland, and I'm a dental hygienist. And I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2025. I also work in public health dental hygiene and have seen firsthand the difference between living in a fluoridated community and a non-fluoridated community, as well as working in a fluoridated community and a non-fluoridated community. I was born and raised in New Mexico, where 76 of the population in the state receives fluoride. And my experience there was that I saw significantly less amounts of dental decay in the children that I saw in the clinics there. Most of these patients were only covered by Medicaid. And similarly, I also had very little need for dental care other than routine care, being that I was exposed to fluoride growing up there. In 1999, I moved to Oregon and began to work in a school-based dental sealant program. The increase in decayed teeth that I saw in the children here was very obvious to me in comparison to those that I saw in New Mexico. The program that I work in targets second and third graders for dental sealants. Out of 5,700 children that were screened last year for sealants, 38% of those kids had untreated dental decay, 37 of them had treated decay, and 25% had no decay. 2% of the children that come into the program, the day we see them, usually have cavities or pain from an abscess tooth. The Oral Health Status of Oregon is a report in 102 that stated that our region has 19% rampant decay, which is rampant is considered seven or more teeth that are decayed, missing, or filled. This is despite the dental services that are being provided by the Oregon Health Plan. The school-based dental program that I work for treats over 200 urgent dental needs in one school district. This is a very small percentage of the need, and it seems as though there's never enough money to treat the dental care in the children that we see. And I believe that the prevention dental decay that water fluoridation would provide is of cost savings as well as in pain reduction, and I think that it's an important decision that our community needs. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate your all coming. At this point, we have Janet Peterson. Is it Kurt Ferre and Jay Myers?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Oswald.
Is there a possibility that we can extend our hearing by a half an hour today?
Representative Dalto, I'm going to announce after these three people that we will extend, that I will extend the hearing. I will excuse any members of the committee that need to go, and if necessary, we will just have it as a subcommittee of the committee to get all of the people who have to testify today an opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jane Myers, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. representing the Oregon Dental Association. I just want to introduce you to dentists who have come down to testify today. Dr. Janet Peterson, who is the president of the Oregon Dental Association and is actively practicing in Corvallis, and Dr. Kurt Frey, who is a general dentist in practice at Permanente Dental Associates in Portland. And they both have testimony on this, and I'll pass out some booklets.
Thank you. HB 2025, requested by the State of Oregon's Health Policy Commission, whose responsibility it is to recommend good health policy to the legislature, is little more than a page long, but it will have a far-reaching and beneficial effect on the oral health of future generations of Oregonians. Simply put, the legislation would help more Oregonians join the more than 145 million people in the 10,000 cities across the U.S. who already enjoy the important public health benefits of fluoridated water. It's appalling that our state, which is nationally noted for innovative and progressive thinking, should rank 48th out of the 50 states in terms of the number of people with access to fluoridated water. Only New Jersey and Hawaii fare worse. The Oregon Health Plan is one of the innovative approaches that my colleagues from other states frequently ask me about. We're all concerned about how to deliver more care, more access to care with the money that's available. Nowhere is this more clear than in our communities as we are all trying to cope with increasing needs and increasing costs. Prevention has to be one of the first tools to consider as we try to meet those needs. We recognize the goodwill of this legislative leaders who have taken up HB 2025 for serious consideration this session. You're not alone in your efforts. Massachusetts, Arkansas, and New Jersey have statewide water fluoridation under consideration. Delaware and Nevada voted it in since the year 2000. They join 12 states plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico that have laws or regulations to bring about statewide water fluoridation. The Healthy Smiles Coalition members and many individuals want to bring you the support you need to enact HB 2025 and change the situation for the better. When the legislation is fully implemented, we estimate that approximately 66% of Oregonians will have access to water fluoridation. HB 2025 is not a complete solution, but it is a good start and one that's long overdue. I will turn the podium over to my colleague, Dr. Ferre, in a moment, but first we want to thank you for your courage and patience to demonstrate to all the people of this state who want to speak on this issue, whether supportive or in opposition. We know that much of what you may hear will demand further explanation, and we are more than willing to help you get the information you need to make a responsible decision. We again want to recommend the Fluoridation Facts book as a compilation of the generally accepted science about the issue, which is extremely useful in getting at the facts about many of the arguments that you've heard today. You will note the list of groups that support water fluoridation, well-known, respected leaders in health and science communities. We ask that you remember that three generations of Americans have grown up with water fluoridation. I see the benefits in my clinical practice, but more importantly, the practical experience is abundant and speaks for itself that water fluoridation should be encouraged by the state's leaders. I encourage you to support the bill, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Janet. Dr. Peterson, we appreciate your testimony, and Kurt?
I'm on.
You're on.
Hi. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and the members of the committee. My name is Kurt Ferre, and I'm here representing the Oregon Dental Association today. I'm a 1976 graduate of Northwestern University in Chicago. Chicago is a city that has been fluoridated since 1956, and the Illinois public water supply today is 99% fluoridated. Now, when I arrived in Portland in May of 1980, on the second day of my practice, I was doing an exam on a 20-year-old female patient. I was on the third tooth of my exam when I realized I was examining her upper denture. I was shocked. I had never seen such a young person in a denture in my 8 years in Chicago. One of my colleagues that day, who was also trained in Illinois, informed me that Portland is not fluoridated. For a second time that day, I was shocked. On September 13th of 2004, the Oregon Health Policy Commission issued a 102-page document on improving the health of Oregonians. Two key principles of this report are invest in prevention, that's where we'll get our greatest bang for our buck, and focus on children. And on page 36 of the commission made the following recommendation. Require the fluoridation of all public water systems in Oregon. Fluoridation is the cornerstone of a comprehensive oral health care policy in any state. I have been asked to discuss the effectiveness of fluoridation and the safety of the chemicals used in fluoridation. Most of this information is already provided in the information binder that you have in front of you. And the effectiveness, I refer to you section 21. Now, I'm not going to go over this a lot. This is the study that Dr. Hersey referenced on Monday and Ms. Campbell just referenced earlier this afternoon. Now, they both stated that the surfaces saved were statistically insignificant, but they missed the most important part of the study, and that is the halo effect of water fluoridation. And again, I think you have two sheets that we've passed out this afternoon that specifically say halo effect. But I want you to visualize a pebble dropped into still water and the resultant ripples that extend out in all directions. Imagine a small, non-fluoridated town in Illinois surrounded by fluoridated communities and where most of the beverages and processed foods consumed by the citizens of that community come from a fluoridated city like Chicago. Therefore, the fluoride pebble, drops in Chicago and radiates outward to benefit this non-fluoridated community. In contrast, compare a small, non-fluoridated town in Oregon where most of the beverages and processed foods come from non-fluoridated cities. They would not enjoy this same ripple effect of fluoride. If you look at the chart of the category on the western region, Oregon, which includes Oregon, the difference is actually 61% difference in two surfaces. I call that statistically significant. I would also like to refer you to a study by Brown, Wall, and Laser from the July 2002 issue of the Journal of the American Dental Association titled Trends and Caries Among Adults 18 to 45 Years of Age. The article focuses on changes in the cavity status of adults 18 to 45 years old in the U.S. between a study that was done during the period from 1971 to 74 and from the period that included 84 to 94. That is a little over 20 years. Comparing the two groups, there was a decrease of over 10 surfaces per person in the second group as compared to the earlier study. The reason is that the younger adults in the first study grew up prior to widespread fluoridation, where the individuals the same age in the second study grew up where fluoridation was widely available. This study shows the cumulative effect of water fluoridation. Some of you on this committee may have been fortunate enough to have grown up in a fluoridated community. You're probably reminded of that fact when you go to your dentist, and either your dentist or your hygienist remarks after looking in your mouth, "You didn't grow up in Oregon, did you?" On July 11th of 2002, the National Academy of Sciences, the largest scientific organization in the world, with over 200 Nobel Prize winners in science and medicine, issued a report reaffirming the effectiveness of fluoride. I refer you to section 12 for the complete report if you're interested. The report states, "Research provides conclusive evidence that fluoridation of the water supply or supplemental fluoride reduces dental cavities, and of all dietary components exhibiting a protective effect against cavities, the most effective is fluoride." We'd like to just mention a few well-known medical and research centers around the country. Research institutions from Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, the Johns Hopkins Medical Center in Baltimore, and the Stanford Medical Center in Palo Alto. What is one thing that these centers all have in common? They're all located in fluoridated communities. The scientists, the doctors, and researchers at these centers work, live, and have raised or are raising families
in these communities. It is my belief that these professionals would not allow fluoridation to continue if it posed any health risks.
Doctor?
Mr. Chair, I have a little section on fluoride chemicals. It's pretty well written up in the written testimony. Do I have time to go over it?
I get you got a cheering squad back there that's wanting you
to continue
to go over, but we are still pressed for time, and I would, could you summarize it? And could I ask, do we have a written copy of your testimony?
Yes, you do.
Okay.
So, well, let me just
summarize
see.
It, if you would.
Well, I just want to say that the fluoride chemicals used in fluoridation, in my opinion, are useful byproducts of the phosphate fertilizer industry. Another byproduct of that industry is phosphoric acid that is found in soft drinks. Fluoride compounds are three of over 40 chemicals that can be added to a public water supply. All of them are toxic in their concentrated forms. Chlorine is a perfect example. But when small amounts are added to a million gallons of water to create a concentration of one parts per million, the fluoride chemically dissociates virtually 100% to their ionic components. That's already been stated today. So I'll just skip a little bit there on the... As far as the product certification, this is done by the National Sanitation Foundation, a well-respected organization and a consortium that they are in that includes the American Water Works Association, the American National Standards Institute, and the Association of State Drinking Water Administrators. Now, Standard 60 was developed by the NSF-led consortium for product certification. In order to meet to a product certification, a contaminant must be present at the tap at a concentration less than 10% of the maximum contaminant level. This is called the maximum allowable level. Oregon requires Standard 60 certification of the fluoride compounds used in our public water supplies, such as right here in Salem, Oregon. What this means is that the compounds used in public water systems are perfectly safe for human consumption. In closing, the two most fluoridated states in the United States are Minnesota at 100% and Illinois at 99% of their respective public water systems. Both of these states got to those high figures because, in part, their elected officials had the vision several years ago to vote for a statewide water mandate. This provided the local communities with the momentum to move forward with fluoridation of the public water supplies. I urge you, Water Committee, to move HB 2025 forward so that all Oregonians someday can enjoy the public health benefit that the Center for Disease Control describes as one of the 10 greatest public health achievements of the 20th century. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. For the members, if necessary, we'll go to a subcommittee at time that members have to leave. If you don't have to leave and want to stay,
I'm also
we'll
willing to
our
stay
discussion.
Late afterwards and answer any questions.
Yeah. Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, with the greatest possible respect to our time constraints. Appreciate you allowing me to ask a question. I just wanted the dentist on the panel to maybe speak to the two issues. One, do you have any information about the statements about the different kinds of fluoride that's being added, some kind of pharmaceutical-grade fluoride that's composed of a chemical substance called sodium fluoride versus what has been described as the toxic waste of the fertilizer industry, some kind of fluoride-containing acid, if you could speak about that. Well, why don't you go ahead and respond to that?
Okay. In your packet, there's an EPA information sheet on the two most common fluoride chemicals.
Okay. And what that is all about is just the very fact that above the
pH of 4, when water is a, do you understand pH?
Yes.
Okay. pH of 7 is neutral. And at neutral, these chemicals completely dissociate to their ionic components. And so no one is drinking these chemicals, okay? So when they say that there's, you know, there's no studies, when I say they, the opposition say that there's no studies, you know, saying that there's no studies on the consumption of these chemicals, well, they're right. But the scientific community does not study at the point of entry where these chemicals. Again, I remember I told you that there's over 40 chemicals, and at the point of entry, they're all toxic. What they rather examine is the where the chemicals come out, and that is at your tap. And at your tap, they are safe. Now, in regards to medical grade and pharmaceutical grade, medical grade is 98% pure. Pharmaceutical grade is 99% pure. Now, I asked Mr. Tom Reeves, a fluoridation engineer who's recently retired from the CDC. I said, what is the difference? And he says, what the difference is that those are inorganic salts like calcium carbonate, which is a common calcium supplement. My wife has a jug of it in our medicine cabinet. Now, in regards to contaminant levels, it is, you know, as far as like sodium fluoride, I have certificate of analysis and specification sheets in my briefcase back there that I could show you later that shows that the contaminant levels, the two most contaminants that are raised by the opposition are lead and arsenic. And I can show you the two diagrams that show that the amount of contaminant is actually less in the industrial grade fluoride than in the pharmaceutical grade in regards to sodium fluoride. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, it does. It leads me to another question, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Bradley.
Thank you. Why anybody would believe that an additive derived from an industrial source would continue to be contaminated at the point that it would be introduced into a municipal water system. I would find it very difficult to believe that contaminants, that those kind of contaminants would make it into a water system at the point where they were introducing it into the water supply. If it did, it would seem, you know, that we'd have a rash of lawsuits against municipal water systems for, you know, poisoning people. I don't understand that. So,
maybe the dilution factor for the three most common chemicals, the hydrofluorosilicic acid is a liquid, and you're adding 4.4 gallons of this to 1 million gallons of water. Okay, and it completely dissociates. The second one, the sodium fluorosilicate, I believe that is a solid, and that's 13 pounds that are added into a million gallons of water to create a one part per million. And the sodium fluoride is 19 pounds of a granule added to 1 million gallons of water. So the dilution factor is immense for these. And so it's the point I'm really trying to say is that the one part per million is almost an incomprehensible amount. And even as a dentist today, I'm amazed that makes a difference. But I see it every day in my practice.
So one final question. How much lead and how much arsenic is also being added to the municipal water supply?
To make a long story short, the average is 0.1 parts per billion. Okay, not million, billion, 0.1. And so to give you some sense of thing, that would
adding,
be...
I guess I was expecting you to say there wasn't an addition of those, but you're saying that is added.
That is the average contamination at the tap due to the fluoride chemicals. Okay, in perspective, that would be one ping pong ball in 10 billion. Okay, and the accepted medical community states in the EPA regulations that is well below any level that would be harmful to human consumption.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Briefly, Mr. Chair, thank you. Are all pharmaceutical drugs that are prescribed by dentists and doctors in the medical industry okayed and checked off by the FDA?
Yeah, I would say yes.
Okay. So, and then what you just said is the pharmaceutical grade fluoride actually is not as pure as the kind of fluoride that we would be adding into.
Well, you know, when they talk about their contaminants, they're talking about 0.001%. And then they say less than is what they say on their certificate of analysis.
Where would you repeat the comment you made about that the, I can't remember what the fact was, that the kind of fluoride that would be added into the water system, you said something is actually purer than what the pharmaceutical grade is. I can't remember what you said there.
Well, I'm just saying that when you compare the certificate of analysis, the U.S. Pharmacopoeia fact sheet that I have in my briefcase for sodium fluoride, and then one of the major producers of sodium fluoride, industrial grade sodium fluoride in this country, is a company called Solvay. They list, you know, the amount of contamination, and the way they do that is a less than a point, blah, 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 blah. And it's listed, the number is actually smaller on the Solvay certificate of analysis than on the one that I have for the sodium fluoride tablets.
In deference to all of the folks who haven't been able yet to testify for us, I'd like to move on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I don't mean to be rude. I'm sorry. Let's see. I better call him. If I can do this. E. David Granham, I think. April Love, and is it Lori Kelly? Pardon me? Okay, if you can come back, that's great. Okay, Jennifer Darling, you to come up?
Dave Branham. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you very much. I am a dentist. I practice with Willamette Dental Group. And I represent the people that don't usually speak up at forums like this. I know that I think there's 18% of the population that's against fluoride, but there's 62% that are for. So it's about, I'm representing that 3-to-1 population that's out there that doesn't usually speak up. And Dr. Furay and Dr. Peterson spoke very eloquently about the benefits of fluoride, and I would encourage support of House Bill 2025. The adjustment of the level of the existing fluoride in the water to approximately 1 part per million helps prevent tooth decay. This is a fact. Organizations with credentials, such as the World Health Organization, support the use of fluoride as safe, effective, and cost-efficient. Fluoridation of toothpaste, water systems, mouthwashes, is not controversial. What is a challenge is to encourage its implementation. We have an opportunity with House Bill 2025 to mandate the implementation efficiently by legislation. Oregon's citizens and legislatures have always been forward in their thinking. We were the first state to legislate real estate laws. We were the first state to keep the beaches open to the public. And I just heard that we are way ahead in seatbelt use, all measures that protect the public. We have an opportunity here to do the right thing for all citizens. Personally, I practiced for 24 years, 10 of which in a small office in North Portland in my high school, Jefferson High School District. And I saw many, many children and adults come in with untreated cavities, little access to care, and even the value of the service is challenged. But with the implementation of the Oregon Health Plan and my association with Willamette Dental Group, which is a very preventive oriented practice, I was personally able to treat more people. But the access is still very poor. We just don't have enough dentist, hygienist, providers to go around. We need to prevent the pathology before it starts. I worked on the fluoride campaign in 1978 when I was a dental student, and it passed. Passed in Portland. The citizens of the city of Portland passed that campaign. But it was not followed through and implemented by ordering the equipment. It brought to the vote again in 1980 and it failed. Thomas Jefferson warned us about the tyranny of the majority. And in this case, just like with Measure 5, the majority prevailed, but did they gain financial stability, which they thought they wanted to have? Some of the things that were stated today, I was back there in the back row kind of seething a little bit about the people that are coming here and presenting to you, this august body of legislatures, misinformation, half-truths, lies. They said it, I'll say it. It's not correct information, and I would apologize that members of the healthcare profession would lie in front of this committee. What we can do with this House measure is do what both the pro-fluoridation people and anti-fluoridation people want to accomplish, and that's good oral health, good systemic health, and protection in the public health arena for the citizens of the state of Oregon. I would very much encourage support of House Bill 2025. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And ma'am, if you can, for the record, state your name. And
my name's Lori Kelly. I'm a limited access hygienist, and I've been practicing for about 20 years, and I have been volunteering for the last 3 years with Head Start, and I've been to, and 4 years for Northwest Medical Teams. I worked in private practice for about 15 years, and the difference between the children that I see in Head Start and the kids I saw in Cambodia last year when I went to Cambodia is appalling. The rate of decay and the kind of decay that I see here with the Head Start kids with all the sugar is ridiculous. I see less decay and decay in the pits and fissures of the teeth in the children in Cambodia. I see bottle mouth. I didn't see bottle mouth and decay in Cambodia. I didn't see anterior teeth rotting to the gum line. I didn't see that in a third world country. It breaks my heart. Last year, I had 78% of the kids that I screened did not get services, even when I helped them. This year, we got a grant from the Oregon Community Foundation and the Oregon Dental Foundation for me to do education, provide fluoride, work with the dental schools, and to get a free clinic going, which we're going to do on February 4th. And it's a lot of work, and I just can't not reach all those kids. And that's why I just can't reach them all. There's 300,000 people in Clackamas County, and there's 350 dentists. How's that going to work?
So it isn't going to work. Do you have a position? It wasn't clear.
I am supporting the fluoridation method because fluoridation bill because we just don't have enough providers to access. The access is ridiculous. OHSU has opened their doors to more. They cut the hygiene program so they can provide more dental dentists and more pediatric dentists. Even though I'm a hygienist, I think that's the right move. We need to provide better access to people. And when they cut, Kulongoski said, or Senator or Governor, sorry, said that he's going to cut the dental. Well, what does that leave us with? You know, it leaves us with less access. So if you're going to cut something, you have to try to replace it with something. And this is the only thing we've got. It feels like it's the only tool in the drawer.
Thank you so much for coming here and testifying. And actually, I just returned from Cambodia, so if you're interested to hear.
Yeah, and they have a lot of them.
Madam Chair, I have one quick question.
Sure.
Have either one of you ever been lobbied by the chemical industry to come out and support fluoridation?
No.
Thank you, Representative. Is there anyone else here, since we're running short on time, that cannot come back on Wednesday that would like to testify today? Okay, we have three hands. How about if you all come up to the dais, and please remember to state your name for the record.
Excuse me, can I ask a question? Next week, those of us who can come back are only those people who are here today and can't testify. Are we going to be the only ones who can testify next Wednesday?
Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee.
No, the hearing next week will be an additional public hearing on the bill, just like today. So for those of you who can come back and testify, and then if there are additional people that want to come on that day, it will be just very similar to today. Those who identify that they're coming over will be the first up on that public hearing portion. Which is why we're asking that you identify yourself so I can see who the carryover is.
Thank you, Sandy. We'll start down on this end, and if you could limit to 3 minutes,
sure.
Because many of us have other meetings that we need to attend, but thank you.
I'll say Chairman.
Just remember to state your name for the record, please.
My name is David Monk. My address is Post Office Box 1106, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. I am the board president for the Oregon Toxics Alliance. Our mission is to eliminate unnecessary toxics use and the harm that causes human health and the environment. So you can see why I'm here and the concern that I have with House Bill 2025. We're quite shocked that the fluoride issue has so much support in the medical community, given the contaminants that are in the industrial grade fluoride that's used. If I think what I'll try to do is just, as you've heard some very compelling arguments, I think, in opposition to 2025, and I would just urge you to use common sense in this. And many of the medical folks have talked about prevention and precautionary approach to this. And it's my position, and I think you would agree that if the goal is to improve dental health for those most at risk, low-income children, I think is what we're talking about, then medicating us all to accomplish that is certainly not the right means to go about it. I think you heard testimony that there are large amounts of fluoride already in many of the products that I'm thinking the products that I know of that contain them are probably many of the products that are used by folks with lower incomes, so that I think many people are receiving, who you're concerned about, are receiving ample doses of fluoride to provide the benefit that I think seemingly it would appear is in much agreement that fluoride has value. It's just how do we provide it to the at-risk population and what is the quality of that fluoride. And so using industrial grade contaminated fluoride is certainly not the means by which to do that. So again, the goal is to help the at-risk population. What are the alternatives? I've heard one spokesperson speaking in favor of 2025 give some financial information that seemed contradictory to me, and I'll reiterate what she said, and perhaps you can look into it, because obviously the cost of providing this is of major concern. Providing some benefits is a major concern to you. I believe what she said was that just the fluoride tablets, pharmaceutical fluoride tablets alone would be something like $1.50 per child, and to administer the program to provide that would be something like $3 per child. And then she went on to say, actually in prior testimony, she said that there was a $15 per child savings by adding fluoride to the water. I don't understand where those numbers come from, and if in fact that $3 per child is an accurate figure, look at the population you're trying to serve. Look at the dollar amount that was provided to you by the Department of Human Services, and I would venture to say you could save a lot of money by providing fluoride tablets to physicians on the Oregon Medical Plan. Thank you.
Thank you. And I apologize, I have a meeting, so I'm handing back to our able chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for staying so late and listening. My name is Mary Lynn O'Brien. I'm a pediatrician, practicing pediatrician in Portland for over 30 years. I'm also a member of the Oregon Pediatric Society and Stand for Children, two groups that have worked for water fluoridation. I say I can also speak for 85 practicing pediatricians in Kaiser Permanente in Multnomah County, which, of course, is not fluoridated. I trained in the East Coast, in a very large East Coast city that was fluoridated, and although I worked with the poorest of the poor, I never saw the dental decay that I saw when I came to Portland in 1975. I was really shocked. In fact, one of the patients that presented fairly early on was a six-year-old boy who had such a severe dental abscess that he actually had a brain abscess, which would have been fatal had it not been treated immediately. So dental disease can actually lead to very severe consequences. My specialty is in developmental pediatrics, kids who have severe developmental problems, and they're even more susceptible because their parents are just struggling to feed and bathe them daily. More difficult to get them to a dentist and get dental care, and their teeth are even in worse condition than the rest of our children. I think, as you probably heard, 6 out of every 10 Oregon children have dental decay or disease, as I call it. It's a disease, infectious disease, as somebody else said. Only 58% of children who qualify for free or reduced lunch get to see a dentist every year versus 85% of kids who don't qualify. So our children of color and children come from non-English speaking families are even more susceptible to this disease. So dental disease, it's the most common chronic illness disease in children. It's 5 times more common than asthma, 7 times more common than hay fever, and it's preventable, and we know fluoride works. So I just urge you to support House Bill 2052. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
I'm Gordon Martin. I'm a commissioner at the Talton Valley Water District. I have, I think, a unique position in contrast to the rest of the people that talked tonight, this afternoon, is that I've been on that side of the podium. We did have a 3-hour testimony concerning fluoridation. 40 people testified, and we were inundated with about 600 pages of information. There was a lot of he said, she said information. The unofficial consensus, I want to make that clear, I'm not representing an official position for the Talton Valley Water District, but the unofficial consensus is that people need to make their own choice on whether they have fluoridated water or not. And so I think if given the chance to bring an official position back from the district, in which we require hearings and agendas and so on and so forth, I believe that is a strong possibility. And a subset of that is that how do you administer it to the individual customers? I think that's where we got bogged down in what to do. We have right now about 70% of our district is fluoridated and about 30% is not. But that needs to be updated, and we are kind of stifled on what to do next because each individual person has their own desires, and force medicating them is not what we want to do, but we don't have a better idea at the moment, and it's still under board consideration. So in conclusion, I think the individual water providers should be given the opportunity to make a determination on whether they fluoridate their water. And secondly, it would be nice to have an opportunity in a month or so to bring back an official position because right now I'm not prepared to present that. So, and my testimony, written testimony, basically says that. Any questions?
No, thank you very much. Representative Schaffer.
Yeah, thank you. I sit on the Sunrise Water Authority Budget Committee in my water district, and I appreciate the call for democracy and the will of the people and all that. But I don't expect you to have the answer to this question. But questions come into my mind during these conversations that I would normally. I'm just wondering how many water districts, water authorities, providers of water in the country went to the vote of their and asked their customers, the people that they provide the water service to, whether or not they should chlorinate the water or not. How many of those districts in this country put it to a vote to the people to chlorinate water? And we can get into the argument about chlorinating is different than fluoridating, but and I bet I can guess the number. It's probably zero.
That's what I would say, because it is a conclusive health issue that if you do not chlorinate, you have the Giardia problem. And so it is a health issue. You would have 100% contamination without the chlorination. I'm pretty sure it's zero myself. And in fact, we get most of our water from the city of Portland, and they have to chlorinate because they do not filter and so on.
And I don't ask that flippantly or disrespectfully,
right,
sir.
Right.
Just thank you very much. I do appreciate the work you do, too, in your community.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your
work. I think everybody else is willing to come over next week, but I'm not sure.
The rest? Please, go ahead. Speak up. The question is there anyone else who is here to testify today that does not want to come over till next week?
Okay.
I get to testify all by myself, or okay?
Well, I don't know. Jane will come up and sit there. It's not that we're discriminating. We don't want to miss your testimony.
My name is Tom Long, and I'm here representing the Citizens for Safe Water, which is a group that was formed directly around the issue that we see as a threat to the area of Tigard, Tualatin, Sherwood, and Tualatin Valley Water District, as well as the town of Wilsonville in drinking Willamette water. We have concerns about that. We've done 6 years worth of research on that, and we have a lot of information from that encourages us to have concern over adding more things to the water than we already have. But I'm not here to talk about that because I don't want to go into a lot of information. You've had enough already. And so simply I'm just going to read what my statement is, and it's short, so you can look forward to leaving soon here if I'm the last one. Our objection to this bill is not about the toxic waste, although we have concerns, that is used as an inexpensive source of mass fluoridation, or the health and environmental impact it may have on our citizens and our waterways when introduced as wastewater. Instead, our objection is to the state of Oregon getting into the costly business of medicating its citizens through the water they drink. That's a topic that concerns us. We are for citizens' choice, and I think that citizens can make a good choice if they're informed. And this is the biggest problem, is getting citizens informed on these issues. I mean, you're looking at one now, and look at the work that's going to be involved in being totally informed on this. It's incredible. But it can be done. And we do feel this process should be left in the hands of individual districts and municipalities. As they are directed by their customers, they are elected officials, and they need to look to the people that elected them to see what the needs of those people are. In our opinion, we feel that it's necessary for them to be the ones making the choice. And I understand that there's two sides to this argument. I will say that I'm against the bill on other principles, but primarily for this reason. Thank you for your time. Do you have any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and I appreciate your testimony, and appreciate your taking the time to come and share it with us. If there are no other individuals to talk or speak on this issue who cannot be back here on Wednesday or don't want to be back here on Wednesday, we stand adjourned.